Amid this pandemic, we proved that paternalistic band-aid solutions were unacceptable. And then we went on to secure the largest ever economic assistance package in the history of this country for excluded workers like undocumented workers.
This win is a win for all working people. We are here and we are essential, and they will never exclude us again.
And none of that would have been possible absent laying that ground game for so many years, building those relationships for so many years, creating space where people could lean on each other and laugh together and cry together and organize together and eat together for so many years.
Welcome to the Practical Radicals podcast. I'm Deepak Bhargava.
And I'm Stephanie Luce. Today on our show, how to build a base of supporters to win a victory few thought possible. Jose Lopez and Angeles Solis from Make the Road New York will tell us how it's done. In our last episode, we introduced the base building model and talked about some of its strengths and weaknesses. I spoke with Greg Nomaker about how his union, SEIU Local 26, used base building to bring more members into the union and win real gains. On this episode, we're going to keep exploring the base building model by looking at how community organizations use it.
So there's a lot that's similar in how community organizing groups do base building and how unions approach the work, but there's some big and important differences too. Stephanie, what do you see as the key differences?
Well, for one thing, unions have to follow a very restrictive set of labor laws, and it actually makes them one of the most highly regulated forms of organization in the United States. And while it's a strength that unions are democratic bodies, it's also a challenge because it means by law, they have to represent everyone in their bargaining unit, including people who don't even believe in unions. So community organizations are organized differently than unions. Deepak, can you talk a bit about what forms they usually take?
Yeah, so community organizations are usually nonprofits, typically charities and social welfare groups under the IRS code, 501c3 and 501c4 organizations that are subject to some of their own limitations because of the source of their funding and their tax status. They can be funded by members or by donors or foundations, and funding from outside parties can create its own contradictions. Community organizing groups take many forms. We talked about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, in the last episode, which played a pivotal role in the 1960s civil rights movement. Today's community organizations exist as neighborhood, city, or statewide groups with individual members who may share certain characteristics, like being low income or working class or people of color. They might be tenants' organizations or federations of churches, synagogues, and mosques. There is a wide variety in the forms these groups take, but all of them involve recruiting people into membership and then taking action on issues together.
Yeah, so it's a wide variety of groups, but there are some common principles that tie them all together. Deepak, can you go through some of those principles?
So I learned a lot from a key mentor, Arnie Graf, who was a legendary organizer with the Industrial Areas Foundation for decades. Arnie got his start in the civil rights movement with CORE and wrote a book called Lessons Learned that offers one of the best distillations of the key principles of community organizing that I've ever seen.
So what's the first principle that Arnie talks about?
The first principle is the importance and centrality of power to achieve social change. Arnie quotes A. Philip Randolph, the founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, an underappreciated but crucial force in the Black freedom struggle in the 20th century. Randolph famously said, quote, "At the banquet table of nature, there are no reserved seats. You get what you can take, and you keep what you can hold." Randolph argued that the key to power for underdogs is inevitably organization.
It's a pretty unsentimental view of how change really happens.
Yeah, and it leads naturally into the second principle, which is self-interest. Arnie talks about how you can't get anywhere in social change unless you understand your own and others' self-interests. And just to be really clear about this, self-interest isn't selfishness. Self-interest is what we want, which can mean our values and our deepest beliefs about how society should be organized and how we should treat each other. And self-interest isn't just about our economic interests, it's about our need as human beings for recognition, for meaning too.
And that really resonates in the union world as well, because a lot of worker struggles are not even just about wages and working conditions, but about dignity and respect.
That's right. And the third principle Arnie discusses is relational power, people working together to discover their self-interests and what they share in common. Building relationships is critical to what we call solidarity power in the book. It's really the foundation of all base building. The fourth principle is the importance of distinguishing between a problem and an issue. A problem is a massive thing, like economic inequality. An issue is something that is more specific and winnable, like a campaign to raise the minimum wage.
But should organizing groups really only work on things that are winnable right now? It seems quite narrow. And there's a real critique of unions and community organizations that are parochial, working on small issues rather than trying to change the system itself.
So that's a fair critique. A lot of community organizations and unions are parochial. But I think it's important to remember that there are many traditions of organizing that emphasize the importance of working on issues that have deep roots, like white supremacy, and won't be solved in a year or by just one campaign. Ella Baker really embodies that tradition of organizing. She and others did spade work for decades, developing local leaders in the South, which created the conditions for the movement upsurge that emerged in the 1960s. Many organizers today work on systemic, long-term issues and try to connect immediate fights to a deeper analysis of racial capitalism. But I still think it's important to be grounded in people's everyday experience and for organizations to work on issues that matter to them, not just on grandiose dreams of a better society. When progressives get disconnected from those everyday issues, from the ground, we get in a lot of trouble.
Yes, for sure. That's a huge problem in our movements. And that's a great segue to your interview with Jose Lopez and Angeles Solis of Make the Road New York. That organization has been deeply grounded in the experience of its members and pushed for aspirational demands that seemed impossible at the time. Finding the balance between a radical vision and practical change in the here and now, it's the very definition of a practical radical.
Jose Lopez is one of the three co-executive directors of Make the Road New York, and Angeles Solis is the lead organizer of Make the Road's Workplace Justice Team. Welcome to the show, Jose and Angeles. We're really excited to have you on. This is one of my favorite stories, examples in the whole book. So I want to start by asking you, hardly anybody when they're growing up as a kid says, I want to be a community organizer. And not too many parents are thrilled when their kids end up doing it. I remember my parents saying something to the effect of, seriously, after all that money we put in, you're going to work for this raggedy community group called Acorn. So it's kind of countercultural, and a lot of people don't understand it. So I just want to start off with some grounding. What is community organizing, or base building, as we call it in the book? Yeah, what does an organizer do every day? And Jose, let's start with you.
Sure. First of all, thanks, Deepak, for allowing us the space to sit with you on the podcast. This is my first podcast, even though I've been in organizing for over 20 years. So it's exciting. Community organizing, to me, in the most basic definition, organizing is really the act of bringing people together to take action toward significant and long-term change. In 2002, Marshall Ganz described organizing simply in saying that organizers identify, recruit, and develop leadership, build community around leadership, and build power out of community. And so for me, there's that question about, like, how do you dissect those three things? Identify and recruit, build community, and build power. All organizing to us here, and I really think in our movement, is based on building relationships. And that really is about finding common ground. Personal relationships are the foundation for mobilizing members into collective action. We can't mobilize people effectively if we don't know what matters to them, if we don't know what motivates them. And it really is through those in-depth, face-to-face conversations that we're building the trust of people that we are in contact with. We get to assess where people stand on issues. We identify people's passions. We understand self-interest. We understand what motivates people. We understand what inhibits people. We ask people why they think things are the way they are. And then we ask people what they think can and should be different. And in that conversation, right, after you're doing so much listening, asking questions and listening, I think a lot of us remember the 80-20 rule, right? Like talk 20% of the time, but really just listen for 80%. Then you can move to agitation. And we've been trying to build up that skill of our staff and our shop to make sure that when we move to agitation, it's about how the problems that the community member named won't fix itself. How some people with power are very comfortable leaving things the way that they are. And how if we don't push those people, it could be that no one ever will, right? And are we comfortable enough in status quo that we're willing to not at least try? And then that organizing conversation moves to goal setting, right? That's the exciting part. That's the like, what are the solutions to the very specific problems that we name and that we want to pursue? At Make the Road, the birthplace of many of our campaigns start in those one-on-one conversations with members. And it gets tested in our weekly committee meetings. It's in our weekly committee meetings and in those spaces where the community determines if the issue that we name is widely and deeply felt, if it is easy to understand, and if it is worth doing something about. And where the answer is yes, that's where we move to build power out of community. So I'll stop. I'll pass it over to Angeles, who might want to get in on this. She's a seasoned, one of our best organizers in-house, and I'm sure has a lot to share on this question.
Thank you, Jose. Jose really spoke to a lot of, I would say, the mechanics of organizing. And I think right now there's a lot of terms, sometimes in philanthropy, academia, advocates themselves using new terms for what really are the fundamentals, right? Distributed leadership or relational organizing. I once saw the whole moving from like agitation to action model called innovation and emerging strategies. And those all have their own values. But at the end of the day, it's like Jose said, organizing really is about moving people from fear or doubt to action. For me, organizing is about listening. It's about being able to sit and live in the nuance of the messiness of community as well, right? Not just the linear strategies of we move people from one-on-ones to meetings to action, but really being able to sit with ourselves as a person in that space. Can you move people from fear to action? Can you listen? Are you willing to ask the right questions? Are you willing to admit when you've gone wrong and confront others when they've gone wrong so that we are not also replicating the dynamics that we are trying to shift in society? Organizing is knowing how to ask the right questions. And I think that's taken, for me, at least a decade of learning, of successful failures, of knowing how to measure people power, of knowing how to question our measurements, how we bring an analysis of race, class, and gender to the work at every level of our work, from our committee spaces to outreach in the streets, to the halls of Albany, to Congress. And then making sure we don't just stay in theory, but live in action, balancing both. Just to speak a little bit about the base organizers that Make the Road, they're meeting people every day, coming through our doors or in the streets, people who are facing deportation, people who are facing eviction, who are facing exploitative conditions in their daily lives at work, right? In a city that every single day becomes more and more unaffordable and unlivable. So they're doing the hard work in organizing, of holding that urgency of the material struggle and suffering in that person's life, trying to bring them into an ideology and then to a shared space where they don't feel alone. And then, as Jose said, being able to define the problems, define the real target who is responsible, and then move towards action. And I just to add on, I think part of our challenge as major organizations in the movement is learning how to not stay in the same cycles of issue-based campaigns, but really long-term strategy and ideology for building power at scale. So no matter the fight, community members know and have an internalized a truth that there is power in organization and not just organizing for issue-based campaigns, but for a real working class movement.
Fantastic. So I really see Make the Road as on the cutting edge of community organizing in the country. And Jose, I'd love you to just tell our listeners a bit more about Make the Road, what it is, its scale, its scope, the range of issues that the organization tackles.
Yeah, absolutely. So Make the Road was founded in 1997 in the rectory of St. Barbara's Church here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. The mission of the organization is to build the power of immigrant and working class communities to achieve dignity and justice. And really our model is advancing core strategies for concrete change at the same time. One of the core pillars is our legal and survival services work. And that really is work to tackle discrimination, abuse, and poverty. Another core pillar is transformative education to develop our members and our leaders and their ability to lead, not just in-house organizationally, but in their homes, on their blocks, in their barrios. The third pillar is community organizing to transform the systems and power structures impacting our neighborhoods. And four is policy innovation, right? Really thinking about how we can rewrite unjust rules and make government and democracy accountable to all of us. The organizing that we do focuses on the intersecting challenges that working class and immigrant New Yorkers face every single day. Overcrowded and under-resourced schools. An economic system that drains resources, health, and good jobs from our neighborhoods. Housing market, where real estate only sees our homes as ATMs, over-policing of young people and trans bodies in our schools and on our streets, and front and center for us, given the people and the demographic of people that we're organizing, is the constant fear of deportation and family separation. And so where do all those things intersect? And how can we make sure that our model, whether it's through legal, through education, through organizing, or through policy, can identify solutions and really tackle some of the underpinnings that create the conditions by which we live by. Our reach in New York extends throughout New York City's five boroughs. We have offices in Brooklyn, in Jackson Heights, Queens, and in Port Richmond, Staten Island. But we also extend into Nassau and Suffolk County and Long Island. And we extend into Westchester County as well. Statewide, we represent over 27,000 members. And these are folks who have joined us because they believe, as we do, that together we can catalyze action and win meaningful victories for our gente. And so that's who we are in a nutshell.
So I'd love to hear from each of you what your own path into movement and to Make the Road has been. And Angeles, why don't we start out with you?
Sure thing. So I grew up in a farm worker community in Eastern Washington and not too far from one of the largest nuclear energy plants in the planet, Hanford, Washington. And I grew up the daughter of a construction worker, of a migrant nurse, and in a union household. And in Eastern Washington, where major agricultural corporations and federal contractors at Hanford literally dictate the conditions in which your neighbors live and dictates the majority of employment in a community, you learn real quick who's the boss. And you also learn real quick the power of organized community. So at 12 years old, I was on the picket line with my dad. He was a union steward. He helped lead a walkout and he was a very active member in his union. And I got to see there that in the union hall and on the picket line that being in a union is not just a matter of politics or better benefits. It's literally a matter of life and death, especially in very dangerous industries. So I was exposed to the power of organizing at a very young age. And I think that forever altered the way that I see the world. I went on to join United Students Against Sweatshops in college, and that's where I was introduced to strategy of the ability to hold hostage economic leverage at a university and how it can shift market power and bring brands like Nike to their knees, right? So it wasn't just that we're going to get together and we're going to fight and we're going to protest. It's what is our strategy? How do we shift power? How do we build numbers to take on the biggest corporations in the world in solidarity with garment worker unions? Went on to SEIU, foundation organizing, and landed at Make the Road because this community organization that primarily was composed of immigrant workers wanted to take on Amazon. And my first few weeks at Make the Road, before I even knew how to do a timesheet, Amazon HQ2 came down to Queens and wanted to colonize Queens in the same way I'd seen them do it in Seattle, not too far from where I grew up. And this community organization said, no, absolutely no, no negotiations, no concessions. Cuomo had already signed a deal behind closed doors. And I saw how community members stood up and said, no, no to criminalization, no to increased surveillance, no to tax breaks, no to helicopters for Jeff Bezos, no to gentrification, and this barrio will be back a billionaire. That was my first campaign at Make the Road New York, and it showed our power that even the most underestimated communities in this country can take on the world's elite and win when there's enough political will, when there is enough people power, and relentless organizing.
What an incredibly powerful story. Thank you for sharing it. And Jose, what's your path into movement and to Make the Road?
So I think you probably know my story well, Deepak. My introduction to movement is Make the Road. I first walked into these doors as a 13-year-old high school student that summer struggling to find summer youth employment. On the inside of these four walls, I met a young woman and founding director by the name of Una Chatterjee. And Una happens to know a thing or two about organizing. And she agitated me by asking, how could it be that there is no money to fund summer youth employment, but the then mayor had a budget allocation of $64.6 million to expand two youth detention centers that were not even at full capacity? That simple question agitated me, and it agitated dozens of young people in Bushwick and hundreds of young people citywide. And so we formed the No More Youth Jails campaign, a coalition of students and allies dedicated to pushing the city to divest from youth jails and invest in youth jobs. By the way, we won. We moved $53 million of the $64.6 million out of the expansion of Crossroads and Horizons Youth Detention Centers. And for me, that effort and that victory at just at that time, 14 years of age, solidified that community organizing is the thing I wanted to do for the rest of my life. 23 years later, and I'm still here.
There's such poetry in seeing your own journey from being a youth member, activist, participating in your first campaign, to being co-executive director of Make the Road New York. It's just amazing. So let's talk a little bit about the role of members in the life of Make the Road, and what's their role, Jose?
By definition, a member agrees with the vision and values of Make the Road New York. The basic idea that we all deserve neighborhoods where we have the freedom to stay and the freedom to thrive, stay in safe, affordable, and dignified homes, and thrive with good paying jobs, with great public schools, and a strong social safety net that is available to all. An active member is engaged and joins two activities per month. And those activities can include attendance at committee meetings. They can include participation in demonstration and action. But activities could also include joining a phone bank or a text bank, or even cooking a meal to help feed other members and allies inside of our weekly meetings. And so that's the kind of difference between how we define member versus active member. And then we have what we call member leaders. And a leader serves on their issue committee's leadership team. And so beyond joining activities, a leader has a vested interest in seeing the organization grow in size and in power. Leaders identify new people who are going to join the organization. A leader is accountable and checks in with the members of their committee. A leader has their ear to the ground and really takes the time to ask others what they need. A leader is a motivator in their committee. They help organizers turn anger into action. And they really remind the membership, the broader base, that all of us have a role in creating our own future. Organizationally, we do our best. We really strive to invest deeply in our member leaders so that when the opportunity comes to fill, say, a staff position, whether that's an organizer position or an advocate position, we work hard to try and fill those roles from within our base. I think that in our work, one mistake we maybe make too often is kind of conflating leadership with the loudest person in the room or the loudest person in the group. And in fact, we believe it's the opposite, right? Like our best leaders are those who listen patiently, are those who respond with questions, and are those who remind all of us to speak with one voice. I know Angeles and our team of leads have been spending a lot of the last few weeks really thinking about effective distributive leadership models. I don't know if you want to add anything here, Angeles, but I'll pass the mic.
I'll quickly say that those closest to the problem know what they need. And that's part of designing that solution together. It's a real honor. And it is quite rare for many community building organizations across the country to have the ability to work so closely with policy designers and movement lawyers to take on a case in our backyard or at our state and say, okay, how can we write a policy that meets the needs of our membership and of our community in the same house? That's a big privilege and has led to some really beautiful work at Make the Road. So I'll say that's something that we have uniquely been able to do over the last few years. And member leaders are very actively engaged in our policy making and then in how we carry it out from beginning to end.
Love that. So Angeles, let's transport ourselves back in time to the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, which was super hard here in New York City. And many of us New Yorkers remember the eerie silent streets, hearing the sirens. I would love for you to share with us what was happening for Make the Road New York members and immigrant communities in New York City at that time.
Mm-hmm. March of 2020, and a few days before the shutdown and the stay-at-home orders, this very vivid memory of waking up at 6 a.m. and riding my bike to the Grove office and putting up handwritten signs that I had made in my kitchen that said, OSHA classes are canceled today. I remember we had made this decision as other organizations had started to sort of take account, hey, maybe we should start moving our folks remotely. We were one of the last organizations to do so just because our members rely on our offices, sometimes for meals, childcare. We have critical services that needed to be done in person and there hadn't been a formal declaration from the state, right? There was pushback. We had OSHA classes that day. It was one of the last ones before our members that also rely on their cards in order to get employment need. So I think Jose was with us on those calls, called a lot of people that night, and folks were confused and frustrated. Oh, let's just have this class. It's okay. It'll be nothing. No, we're going to cancel it and we're going to stay safe for now until we know more. We were so in the dark, literally, about what was going to happen. And then the calls started coming in that the first positive cases had been in our office and our community members. I share this often, but I think it was for 6 weeks or so, we lost 90 members of our organization. Folks that we had shared birthdays with, folks we had gone to Albany with, people that I have memories of, you know, speaking outside of really powerful press conferences and outside of detention centers, we had to say goodbye to. And as we all know, COVID pulled back the covers on broken systems and exacerbated what was already there. No access to healthcare, limited access to resources, living in food deserts, fear of going to authorities, Our community members are often denied sick pay, labor protections, and more, but that was just exacerbated under COVID. And then the second disaster to really hit our community was unemployment, mass unemployment. And that's when we started putting the numbers together. 1 in 4 of our members could not pay rent. 1 in 4 of our members could not put food on the table. Almost the majority of our membership was excluded from unemployment insurance. So stay at home was not an option. You have one option. You go out and find work where there is none, or you take work that puts your life at risk, especially where you are denied often the protections that you need, PPE, and those things that I mentioned. The same time that our people were dying, billionaires and multimillionaires were cashing in on the pandemic, where our social safety net and our public hospitals were starved for resources. The elite were hoarding massive amounts of wealth. And this is happening at the same time that thousands of people are struggling to put food on the table, provide for themselves or their family. We saw the divisions of wealth and who has access to what life critical resources very clearly displayed.
Such a powerful story. And immigrant New York was hit so hard by the pandemic, and so much of the essential workers that the city and communities relied on day to day for food, for care, for really essential work. One of the best campaigns that I have ever seen in 30 years of organizing was the campaign to win the Excluded Worker Fund, which is really a path-breaking policy that provided $15,000 on average to undocumented immigrant workers who were excluded from federal assistance. And as somebody who's worked on income support policy for, you know, my whole career, it's really no exaggeration to say that nothing like this had ever been done before in the United States. It made history in U.S. social policy. And I guess I want to start by asking you, Angeles, how did you come up with such a bold demand?
As I said before, the people closest to the problem know what they need. Community building, mutual aid, creative ingenuity have always been at the heart of immigrant cultures, of our values, of our resilience, of our survival. And amid this pandemic, we proved that paternalistic band-aid solutions were unacceptable. And then we went on to secure the largest ever economic assistance package in the history of this country for excluded workers like undocumented workers. And in that fight, we centered the leadership and the experiences of undocumented workers fighting for that transformative change. So to answer your question about how we came up to that demand, the conditions were right, and I can speak to those conditions later on and how we were able to navigate the right components to pull this win across the finish line. Stimulus checks, unemployment insurance, gift cards from foundations to some community organizations in the city in the range of $300 to $1,000. And it became very clear when someone is trying to figure out how to just get a bag of beans and rice and toilet paper that's already barely on the racks at the grocery shelf, who has the money to get that or not, right? And $1,000 all of a sudden becomes a lot of money when you have no income coming in and rent is still due. That was just a very clear agitator, right? Who is getting UI and who is not? So we went for parity. We went for parity. We did not go for, we need some, a relief fund, or we need some, you know, economic support for our communities and whatever the state can dish together. We came out with a bold demand that said, those that pay into the social safety net, those that pay into unemployment insurance, so that at the very least have returned to them what they have earned. And even those that cannot prove that they pay, or even those that do not pay, should still have access to life-saving support in order to make it through this pandemic. A lot of folks don't know this, but unemployment insurance actually came out of the Great Depression, one of the worst crises in our country. And it was because it showed that at the end of the day, what we need in order to keep our economy afloat is people's ability to pay into the economy. And they cannot do that. They do not have the resources to do so. So we did the numbers. We did the math. We sat down and we said, we're going to demand unemployment insurance for excluded workers who at that time and still to this day continue to be undocumented workers, cash economy workers, and people leaving incarceration. So we put the policy together. It was over $4 billion ask. And we were very strategic and said, we're also going to tie it to a billionaire's tax. We're going to tie it to a tax that is going to bring in so much money for the state, and we're just going to ask for a smaller piece of that pie. Because we already know we're underestimated. Because we already know that when everything is in crisis, the last, when nurses and firefighters and frontline responders don't even have the resources of what they need, how are we going to make sure that the state also takes care of the people that pick up trash in the parks to survive? So we had to make sure that we also were bringing a solution to the hardest question, which is, how are you going to pay for it? And then we're going to start tackling all of the racist and xenophobic and other barriers that were going to make it hard to push this across the finish line. But I can speak to that as well. That's how we came up with the demand.
Beautiful. And such, it speaks so powerfully to the importance of being rooted in people's everyday experiences, in their suffering, in their pain, and not starting with just what's realistic or what will the governor give you out of the goodness of his heart. So tell us about how was this campaign won? What were some of the pivotal moments that you remember? How did community members just participate in and lead the campaign? Just kind of bring this to life for us.
If it's okay for me to quote Lennon, I've seen this around, but it really speaks to the story that we're still continuing to tell 3 years later, right? He said, there are decades where nothing happens and there are weeks where decades happen. And that was very indicative of what happened in those 6 to 12 weeks of that weird legislative session in 2020, when legislators got to say, well, I got to work and stay at home, but the people that they represent were out there pushing elevator doors to deliver food, cleaning up in the streets, picking the food that everyone was, you know, eating to survive. Domestic workers are taking care of people's children so that they can work from Zoom. Again, the class divide was more visible and at the same time more invisible than ever because people could stay at home. And in the meantime, we were seeing our people struggling to survive in the streets. So I'll get to the components of what it took to win the Fund Excluded Workers campaign in 2020. But I will say, having organized for almost a decade now, one of the biggest challenges for organizers that has always persisted is not just being able to name the obvious factors that break apart movements before they even begin. Union busting firms, deregulation, divide and conquer tactics, increased surveillance in the workplace, et cetera. One of the hardest fights for an organizer and for community members amongst themselves is undoing the deeply conditioned and internalized beliefs that they have to earn their value, that they have to earn basic protections, that most governments outside of the US agree that basic protections are not privileges. So we had to start with tackling that. And we did that in pantry lanes. We started in pantry lanes. When thousands of people and hundreds of folks were lined up around the block in Queens and Brooklyn, the Bronx, we went to pantry lanes. And as folks were waiting in line, it was a perfect organizing moment. How do you feel that you've been in this country for 10, 15 years, that you've worked tirelessly, that you've paid your taxes, and you see that the multimillionaires are gaining all these tax breaks and making billions a day, and you're here figuring out how you're going to keep your home? It was a perfect agitating opportunity. They had nowhere to go, so they had to listen to us. But that's how we got folks agitated. You know what? I did think, you know, because this country treats me as a second-class citizen, that I don't deserve UI, or, you know, I don't have my status, or I don't have a green card, and I have it. You've paid into it. All those little numbers at the bottom of your check, or even if you work in cash, you still contribute. And this is still your home, so you should be able to survive and not be in this position. So it was a perfect agitating moment to be able to build on the politicization of our folks. So number one, we politicized our people. And we put the onus of responsibility on the state. How do we do that? With number two, our narrative. The conditions were right for a narrative that broke through. Again, we can have the same campaign message for 10 years, and then the moment comes along when it finally resounds. And that was essential and excluded. We didn't call it the undocumented workers fine. We knew that politically that was never going to make it through. We called it the Excluded Workers Fund because it put the onus of responsibility on the state that was excluding the people that I was supposed to protect rather than including them. And those same people were the essential workers that were getting applause at 6 p.m. every day, that Governor Cuomo is putting statues of. Those statues did not help our people survive. Those statues did not put food on the table. So with that breakthrough narrative, essential and excluded, y nosotros que, primarily led by Endelon at that time, what about us? Started to pull back the covers on who's responsible, who's benefiting, and who's losing. And that narrative, along with the public sympathy for essential workers at the time, helped gain the moral high ground, to put power behind what some folks wanted to say our demand was unrealistic. And then what the majority started to agree, actually, you know what? They do deserve, at minimum, something to be able to provide for their families if they're risking their lives, etc. So politicizing our folks, really, really starting with tackling those beliefs that unemployment is a right and not a benefit just to those that are eligible. Number two, the narrative. The number three, principles, values, and really bold direct action. We started bringing folks together that were already saying to us, either I can keep making calls to my legislators from home, but if something doesn't happen, I'm going to die at home anyway, right? So we started taking to the streets. I remember as an organizer, this is a big responsibility. This is before the vaccine. This is before we really knew what COVID, the intensities of how the virus could develop. But we knew that we had to visibilize the workers that many people at home behind their doors were not seeing. So we started with FAS outside of Jeff Bezos' penthouse apartment in Manhattan. We started thinking, all right, we'll get 10, 15, a bunch of immigrant workers together, and we'll sleep outside. We won't eat to show what's happening in our homes. And then it became 50, then it became 70, it became 100, over 100 immigrant workers fasting outside of Jeff Bezos' penthouse apartment. Tax the billionaires in order to fund the poor. That message started breaking through. We started doing major mobilizations, taking all the protections we could to keep our people safe. And then we moved to shutting down bridges, talking about a largely undocumented, or even for those in reentry, high-risk population of doing direct actions during a pandemic, not just for their individual safety, but also you're risking deportation, you're risking arrest. But because people were so desperate and so angry, we were asking them the question, what are you willing to do to win? And they were willing to shut down bridges. They were willing to put their bodies on the line for a 23-day hunger strike in order to demonstrate the urgency that our communities were facing. So bold direct action. And lastly, a really smart inside-outside strategy. We had legislators on the inside, the halls of Albany, that were deeply connected to the struggle of those taking these actions across the city and the state in order to bring this demand to the governor's table and say, you need to do something. New York was getting national attention. We had to do something that proved that we were also leading the way for immigrant and excluded communities. So that inside-outside strategy, coupled with the narrative, coupled with direct action, there was so much pressure on the legislature to do something that eventually they had to. And when I saw that $2.1 billion headline, I remember literally dropping the lunch I had in front of me and just running to the members and feeling this joy. And also, we did this. We were able to do this. We had to believe that it was possible. We could not give up. It was already such a wild demand that if we didn't think that it was possible, then our community members taking these risks wouldn't either. And the same day that we celebrated our victory, the same day that we ended our hunger strike, excluded workers in New Jersey started their hunger strike on the steps of their Capitol. And since this win, we've seen 11 other states take on the banner of essential and excluded, take on excluded worker and safety net campaigns, and demand unemployment insurance for excluded workers across their states. Some have already won permanent funds, and we're still in the fight to do the same for us as well.
It's a really incredible story. And I remember when the victory was won and that $2.1 billion was achieved, and I was about to go into a class, and a couple of my students had volunteered in the campaign and were incredibly excited about it, and I broke out in tears. And I don't cry for nobody, just to be clear. So this was an incredible piece of history that you all made. So you met this moment in history, but it didn't come out of nowhere, right? There had been sort of a power base built here over many, many years that could be leveraged and deployed to meet the moment. So Jose, I'd love for you to talk about that. Like, why was it so important to have this kind of organized base in order to be able to capitalize when this crisis hit and to meet the moment in the way that you did?
During the early pandemic, much of our city was on lockdown. Our operations at Make the Road New York went virtual to some degree. But I think, as you said, because of our relationship building and leadership tracking, we were able to devise an operation to stay in daily contact with our membership. I think COVID-19 is the case for proving that relational organizing matters. And I'll give you two examples. And I think Angeles just named one of them. We run a food pantry. We serve hundreds of New Yorkers every single week. When COVID hit, we had to call an audible. We had to figure out how to get food to our people. It was staff, it was members, and it was volunteers who pulled lessons from other mutual aid groups and who had coordinated a drop-off pantry service. Our staff and leaders used their cars, their bikes, their feet to bring groceries to the doorstep of the neediest New Yorkers in the safest and most secure way that we could devise given the circumstance. Now, Angeles, credit to her, she was critical to pulling that operation off. And I think she will tell you, people stepped up in such a beautiful way to take care of other people. And this is testament, not just to relational organizing, but also to the politicization of our members who understood that this was a moment where government wasn't going to step up for people. And so we had to, right? We had to be that alternative. The second example is this work that was just named to pass the Excluded Worker Fund. Again, during the height of COVID, our tios and our tias decided to go on hunger strike for 23 days. This is the longest hunger strike that we have ever participated in as an organization, and probably during the hardest moment in our lives. Again, the willingness to carry out such a demonstration was rooted not just in the need, right? Members articulated that they already couldn't afford to put food on the table, but it was also rooted in relationship and it was rooted in solidarity. I am willing to put my body on the line because my friend, neighbor, community, comrade is willing to do the same. And we're willing to do that in the interest of our entire community who is under so much pain and suffering in this moment. And none of that would have been possible absent laying that ground game for so many years, building those relationships for so many years, creating space where people could lean on each other and laugh together and cry together and organize together and eat together for so many years. And so, again, like just a reminder that organizing in its basic form is really just about community. It's about building those relationships so that when these hard moments present themselves, it's much easier to kind of knit that fabric of community and care where we really do, in fact, as we did during COVID, take care of each other.
Beautiful. So you both and Make the Road are kind of upholding this tradition of organizing. And a lot of people are saying, well, you know, people don't have time to be part of organizations, or they're saying the craft of organizing is in decline. And, you know, why do we need organizing? We just have social media. We can mobilize people anytime we want to. What to you is the future of organizing as you contemplate it as a craft? What's important to preserve, to sustain, to teach for all the generations to come? Angeles, I might start with you.
We are seeing masses of incredible momentum-based organizing right now where we see people are willing to take to the streets in numbers. Our challenge as organizers is to be able to move that energy and shift the conditions of power at every level of government and even within our own community.
Fantastic. Jose?
Every night of the week, 30, 40, 50 members gather in our community spaces. And they do that to hug, to laugh, to listen, to strategize, to break bread together. Each of them have their own reasons, right? Some maybe left everyone and everything that they know back in their home country and they're in search of community. Some may need access to a hot meal that maybe we can provide. Some bask in the care, laughter, and warmth felt by their neighbors, other members, our staff. Some maybe appreciate the service that they received and feel an obligation to help their neighbor as their neighbor helped them. But I think all of them, all of us want to see everyone in space, everyone in community be treated with respect and dignity. And I want the listener to remember that, right? Think about that. 40 to 50 people every single night are coming into our offices. Times are hard, right? Like people have kids, people work two jobs. TV is probably better than it's ever been, right? Like our communities can be doing so many other things, but they choose to be with each other, right? They choose to be with us. And knowing that, we have to think about the sanctity of time and space. Time, right? Like we all have that relative who calls when they need something, but they won't call otherwise. At some point, what do? You just stop answering that phone call. Don't be that, right? Like don't be that person in the community. Our neighbors and members are worthy of so much more. Deb Axt, my predecessor, dear friend, used to always say to us, relationship before task, relationship before task. And anyone listening should remember that, like write that shit on your arm, relationship before task, because it is important. And also space, like, you know, when people dedicate 2 hours of their time to us in a weekly meeting, it has to be worth their while, right? You have to use that space to honor them. You have to use that space to celebrate them. You have to use that space to teach each other, not teach them, have everyone in that space teach each other, and use that space to move people to action. And so if nothing else, right, I'm pretty basic when it comes to organizing principles. I believe that organizing is about relationships. I believe that we have to meet people where they are, not where we want them to be. And I think we have to remind people that the reason we're bonding together in this moment is because we understand that the status quo sucks, right? And in order to improve the status quo, we have to offer our communities hope, and then alternative, and the only path forward is the path that we walk together.
Annalise and Jose, it was really a gift to start the week with the two of you. That was amazing. You were great. Thank you so much for it. And your stars, really appreciate the work you do and how you showed up today.
Thanks
for having us, Deepak. We appreciate it.
Base-building organizations like Make the Road have won incredible gains for their members and the broader population. They can make a real impact in people's lives, sometimes even the difference between life and death. The base-building model is a pillar for underdogs to make social change. We need to reclaim much of the lineage that's emphasized the slow and steady work and the patient efforts to build relationships with neighbors and coworkers. Especially in this age of social media, people have lost sight of the importance of this deep, relationship-based work, much of which has to happen face-to-face.
But this work can be slow and plodding, and by itself, it doesn't usually rise to the scale we need for transformative change on big national or global issues. Base-building organizations can sometimes have a tendency to focus narrowly on the interests of existing members or on small local issues they can win. So a big question is, how can we take the best of the base building model and pair it with other strategies that might be able to reach many more people and win bigger demands?
At the end of our book, Practical Radicals, we offer 36 strategy tools. One that relates to base building in particular is Tool 11, the Leadership Identification Tool. This helps organizers find people who are really able to move others in their community and workplaces.
And a second tool, Tool 35, is one we borrowed from the Maine People's Alliance. This is known as the Leadership Ladder, which organizers use to help create paths for volunteer members to take on more and more responsibility in their organizations. Groups like Make the Road use tools like this to build powerful membership-driven organizations.
In the next episode of Practical Radicals, we'll talk about the second strategy model, disruptive movements. We'll be joined by Frances Fox Piven, the legendary scholar activist who has taught so many of us about the power of disruption.
The property classes want to stomp on people at the bottom, and people at the bottom have to rise up again and again and again.
Practical Radicals is made possible with support from the Roosevelt Institute. Harry Hanbury and Peter Kakoma produced the series, and Peter Kakoma is the series editor. Our theme music was composed by Christian Perez Yates and performed by Trio Gafas, with additional music by Peter Kakoma and Christian Perez Yates. If you enjoy the show, please follow and rate it on your podcast app and share it with friends. And join us next time for more practical and radical strategies to change the world.